the beginning of this week's Sedra, the Torah tells us that you should bring your bikurim, your first fruits, to the Kohen Asher Biyomecha, Asher Yeh Bayomim Hohen. The Kohen who will be ministering in your days at that time. And we find a similar phrase by the time when a person has to go to a judge. It says also, El HaShofet Asher Yeh Bayomim Hohen. You go to the judge who will be around in that time. And Chazal point out, Ein Lecha Shofet Ve'ein Lecha Kohen Ela Shebiyomecha. You only have the option to go to the Kohen or the Shofet who lives in your time. Which seems to be obvious. You can't go to a Kohen or a Shofet who lives after your time or lives before your time. So what's the intention? Ela Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro. That Yiftach in his generation was equal to Shmuel Bedoro and so on. That every generation you have to respect the leadership of your generation as much as they respected the leadership of previous generations who may have been greater, but you can only relate to the Shofet of the Kohen of your generation. Now on the surface that may seem like Nebuch b'di'evid, right? You know, if we could go to the Vilna Gaon, or we could go to Aaron HaKohen, that would be ideal. But Nebuch, we can't, so we're stuck with the Kohen or the Shofet. In our generation, the Torah tells us, respect him as much as they respected the greater Shoftim and greater Kohanim of previous generations. We'll see that's not the idea at all, and there's a tremendous important lesson here for many, many things in life and in the observance of Torah. First of all, let me start with something that will give a preface to this concept. The Torah says that when they received the Torah, so when they came to Midbar Sinai, it says, Bayom Hazeh Bo Midbar Sinai. On this day, they came into Midbar Sinai, which happened to be Rosh Chodesh Sivan. So Chazal comment, it doesn't say Bayom Hahu, on that day, but Bayom Hazeh, on this day. B'chol Yom Yiyu Beineichem Kechadoshim Ki'ilu Hayom Nitna. Every day the Torah has to be new to you as if it was given that day. That's the lesson from that pasuk. Now, the truth is that that's a very difficult lesson, because if it means simply that the Torah should always be new and exciting and not become old and hackneyed, then how do we learn it from this sentence? There are other sentences in the Torah that teach me that lesson. The commandments that I'm commanding you today should be on your heart. Don't look at them as if they've been commanded in the past and they're old, but lamaisa, they're as if you got them today, new, exciting, whatever. That's mentioned in the Torah and other places. But in this specific place, the lesson doesn't seem to fit the sentence. Because when did they come to Midbar Sinai? On Rosh Chodesh Sivan. That was 6 or 7 days, according to different opinions, before the giving of the Torah. The Torah was not given on that day. So how can we learn from that pasuk, on this day they came to Midbar Sinai, that every day the Torah should be new to you like it was given that day? Nothing was given that day. So what do you tell me? It was a process. The process of giving the Torah took 6 or 7 days. Each day something else occurred. And referring to that process, that whole process is called the giving of the Torah. That's not true either, because the Gemara happens to give a very detailed chronology of what happened day by day in those days leading up to the giving of the Torah. And the Gemara says, according to everyone, that first day that they came to Midbar Sinai, nothing happened. The Ribbono Shel Olam didn't speak to Moshe. Moshe didn't speak to the people. They rested that day. Because they were tired from traveling. And therefore, they had just traveled from Rephidim, right? They were tired. They wanted to unpack, get some rest, and the Ribbono Shel Olam left them alone. So that first day, that day, Rosh Chodesh, nothing happened. Zero. So how can we learn from that day that every day the Torah should be new to you like it was given that day, when nothing happened that day? They rested that day. So I was thinking that that's exactly the lesson. Here, God has been waiting since before creation to give the Torah, right? You just need the right time, the right place, the right number of Jews, right? And here it is, the right time, right place, right number of Jews. They're now in Midbar Sinai. Let's get on with it. Let's start as soon as we can. And yet the Rebbe Mishlam assesses the situation. He sees the Jewish people are tired. And if I start up with them today about the Torah, it's going to be counterproductive, right? They're not in the mood. They're going to be kvetchy. So let them rest. Tomorrow morning, they'll be refreshed. Tomorrow morning, we'll start the process, because that's what's more beneficial. That's what we learn from this pasuk. The chol yom yu beinechem kechadoshim. Every single day, you have to reassess the Torah according to the circumstances of that day and relate to it accordingly. You can't relate to the Torah in all times and all places and all circumstances the same way. You have to be able to relate in all times and all circumstances, but not necessarily the same way. Some days need one kind of approach, some days and some places need a different kind of approach. Right? The Torah doesn't change, but your association with it and how you relate to it and how you package it has to change according to time, place, circumstance. Right? All those things are very important, and therefore every single day a person has to reassess anew his relationship to the Torah, just as HaKadosh Baruch Hu reassessed anew that first day and decided that it's counterproductive to start with them, rather let them rest. And the next day we'll start up. This is not a day to start the process of giving the Torah, this is a day to let them rest. To give you an idea of how that applies, Lamaisa, let's discuss a Michtav Meliyahu and something from the Chazon Ish. That we see that the Torah really has to be applied different ways in different situations, different generations even. The Michtav Meliyahu says that every generation has its Yetzer Hara. Every generation has a different Yetzer Hara. And the way to fight that Yetzer Hara is with the tools of the Yetzer Hara himself, to fight fire with fire. You fight the Yetzer Hara on his ground. And that is the avoda of that generation. Example he gives, in the Rambam's generation, the Yetzer Hara was Greek philosophy. So, therefore, the Rambam combated that Yetzer Hara with philosophy. And he wrote the Mora Nevuchim. And he showed that what the people believed, that Aristotle was the last word of truth, right? And whatever Aristotle said was true, and where Aristotle differed with the Torah, Aristotle was right. That was the Yetzer Hara of the generation. So the Rambam showed that in those areas where Aristotle was right, he was right, and in those areas where he differed with the Torah, he was wrong, and the Torah was right. And he showed philosophically the errors of Aristotle, and in that way he fought the Yetzer Hara of the generation. Mora Nevuchim, Guide to the Perplexed. So now you are all in Iyat, that is very much involved in Kiruv. So if you believe that the Torah never changes, nothing ever changes, how you relate to the Torah, whatever, is constant. So you don't need to learn how to be Makariv people or whatever, right? What you need to do is know how to go print up Mora Nevuchims. So you can and translate them into a language that people understand, and go to the pubs in Kikar Tzion, get everybody out of there, and say, I know why you're estranged from Judaism, because you think Aristotle is the last word in truth. And I'm going to read you passages from the Guide to the Perplexed that will convince you that Aristotle is wrong and the Torah is right in those areas where they disagree. What? Oh yeah, it's written in English, right? If I, what? They're fine. So you'll teach it the right way, and you will be makariv people by teaching them Mora Nevuchim. What? Yeah. And you'll be not successful with anyone almost. Yeah. Well, hold on. Let me finish the thought. Okay. You don't even know what I'm saying yet. If nothing changes, then the Rambam was very successful in bringing people back to Yiddishkeit by writing Mor Nevuchim, then that's the way we should bring people back to Yiddishkeit today, by teaching them Mor Nevuchim. The answer is, it's a different world. It's a different generation. The Yetzer Hara of this generation is not Greek philosophy. It's not any philosophy, for that matter. Most people, with very few exceptions, are not estranged from Judaism because they believe in Greek philosophy or any other philosophy. It's a different Yetzer Hara. It's a more materialistic Yetzer Hara today, right? The Yetzer Hara today is people having to be fulfilled and very selfish, motivated kind of philosophy. Has nothing to do with Greek philosophy. And therefore, if you go and preach Greek philosophy to people and teach them why it's wrong in the cases where it differs with the Torah, you're not going to accomplish anything. Even though the Rambam accomplished a lot with it, because the Rambam was dealing with his generation, and the generation today is completely different. Today, people don't know who Aristotle was. They think he was a rock star, maybe. I don't know what Aristotle was. So, Torah doesn't change, but the way that you deal and package a Torah has to change because people change. And what is the Yetzer Hara, like the Michtam Eliyahu says, is how you have to fight it. And if you don't understand that, and you're fighting battles of different generations, you're not going to be successful. So therefore, the Torah here has to adapt to the time, the place, the Yetzer Hara, and that's how you have to package it. I'll give you another example. In the 1950s, they created, the Gedolei Yisrael created the Chinuch Atzmoi system. That was an independent education system here, not beholden under the wings of the government. Okay, and the question came up: what language of instruction would be used in the Chinuch Atzmoi schools? What would be the language that they would teach in? Now, many people assumed it definitely would not be Ivrit, not be modern Hebrew, because the old Yishuv, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, right, made a holy war against Hebrew. Right, they refused to speak Hebrew; they only spoke Yiddish, and they made a war against modern Hebrew. They called it Ivrit, and spelled it Ayin Vav Vav Resh Yud Tav, the blind language, the language of the blind, Ivrit. And supposedly, I heard this, saw this ma'ase in print about Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. I once said it over to a group of Beis Yaakov teachers, and one of them told me that the story is about her grandfather, the Magid of Yerushalayim, Rav Yadler, and it was about him. But I saw it in print about Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, so I'll say it how I saw it in print, but somebody said it was about her grandfather, Rav Yadler. It makes no difference who it was about, the message is the same. Supposedly, either Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld or Rav Yadler, right, met Eliezer ben Yehuda, who is the father of modern Hebrew. And Eliezer ben Yehuda said to them, I don't understand the Rav. What does he have against Hebrew? Hebrew is Lashon HaKodesh, right? How can you make a war against Lashon HaKodesh? So the other responded, it says in Shir HaShirim, Chicheich Kiyein HaTov, your palate, your mouth, is like good wine. He said the meaning is the following. Wine also is a very holy thing. Wine you can use for benching, for havdalah, for kiddush, for a chasana, right? Very holy things you can do with wine. But if a person who is unfit touches the wine, it prohibits the wine from being drunk. Similarly, he said, language is similar to wine. The language can be Lashon HaKodesh, a holy tongue. But if the wrong person like you touches it, it becomes unfit to speak. Supposedly, Eliezer ben Yehuda responded, Harav medaber shtusim. That's foolish. To which Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld responded, Be'ivrit omrim shtuyot. Not shtusim. In any case, whether that happened or not, I'm not sure. But it's a nice story. Okay, so everybody assumed that the language in the Torah schools, the independent Torah schools, was not going to be Ivrit. They came to the Chazon Ish to paskin what language should be used for the language of instruction in the Chinuch Atzmoi schools, and the Chazon Ish says, spoken modern Hebrew, Ivrit. That's what's spoken in the Beis Yaakovs, that's what language they teach it. So there were people who wanted to put the Chazon Ish in Cherem right away. You know, Chazon Ish, one of the Derech, right? He's a Zionist. He's espousing teaching modern Hebrew in our schools. So somebody went to ask the Chazon Ish for an explanation. What's going on? So he said the following. He said, if you had a general who was an expert strategist in World War I, and now it's World War II, you take him out of retirement, and you ask him to give you a strategy, a battle plan for an air battle that's going to take place. And he gives you a plan that fits box planes. Put him back in retirement, because that's not the battle that's being fought. The battle that's being fought is amongst jet planes, not box planes. In World War I, they fought box planes, so there was one strategy. Now there's jet planes, not the same strategy. The battles change. And therefore, the kalim, the utensils, the machinery you need to fight those battles, and the strategy you need is different. So Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld was fighting a war against people who grew up in frum homes, threw off the yoke of Torah, but felt guilty. And they needed a substitute for Torah. So they substituted the Torah with Eretz Yisrael, with Lashon HaKodesh. Right? As long as you speak Hebrew and you live in Israel, you don't need a Torah. Torah was for Chutz Laretz. Torah was for the Golus, when you needed that to separate you from the Goyim. But here, if you live in Israel and you speak Hebrew, that separates you from the Goyim. You don't need any mitzvahs. So they, in order to ease their consciences, they used Hebrew and Eretz Yisrael as a substitute for Torah. Then the battle was to show them that this is not important at all. We're not even going to speak that language. We don't recognize it at all. Right, to let them know that they couldn't ease their consciences with this, because that's not an ikur, that's not important at all. What's important is Shmiras HaTorah, Shmiras HaMitzvah. And therefore, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld made a holy war against Ivrit in his generation. Says the Chazon Ish, we're two generations after that. We've lost that battle. Right? We've lost the battle with those people. Now we're fighting a different battle. We're fighting a battle with people who are totally estranged from the Torah and grew up in homes that were totally estranged from the Torah in two generations. They don't need a substitute for the Torah. They don't need Hebrew and Eretz Israel to substitute the Torah. They don't have an idea what the Torah is. And therefore, we're going to lose an entire generation if we don't teach in our schools in the vernacular where we could possibly attract those people who would be then impressed with our education. But if we're going to teach in Yiddish and close off our institutions totally to anyone who could become attracted, right, then we're going to lose them. So we're fighting a different battle, different people, and therefore we need to fight it differently. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld was 100% right in his time in the situation he was in. And the situation now is different, and therefore the way we fight it has to be different. Of course, the generals have to be the ones to decide what weapons you use and what strategy you use. But Lemaisa, the Torah doesn't change. But the way that you deal with it and the way you use it in different situations changes. Let's see another idea. When they left Mitzrayim, the Ribbono Shel Olam commanded them to take gold and silver. That you're familiar with. But many people forget there was a third thing that God commanded us to take. Egyptian clothing. Smalos. Take clothing. And the Torah also directed us what to do with that clothing. V'samtem al b'neichem v'al b'noseichem. Don't use the clothing as shmatis. Put it on your children. Clothe your children in this clothing. Now that sounds wild. Because one of the zechuyos we had, one of the merits we had to be able to leave Egypt is that we didn't wear Egyptian clothing for the 210 years that we were there. Lo shinu es malbusha. And now we're going out of Egypt, and God says, take the Egyptian clothing, put it on your kids. What kind of chinuch is that? Our children should wear Egyptian clothing. It was a masquerade party. What was the purpose of it? So there are many different explanations of this. And what I'm going to tell you, I think, is very close to being the true shot here. Okay, at least I think so. And if it's not, the idea is true no matter what. And that's the following. The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted us to know that there was absolutely nothing wrong halachically with wearing Egyptian clothing from a Shulchan Aruch standpoint. Meaning, if you go through the four sections of the Shulchan Aruch, you couldn't find anything wrong intrinsically with the Egyptian clothing. It wouldn't have been shatnez. It wouldn't have been not sonua, it would have not been immodest. Because if it would have been any of those things, they couldn't have worn it now. How could you put it on your children if it's immodest, or it's what's it called, or it's shotnez, or any other thing that could be wrong with clothing? Okay? Can't think of anything right now. But anything else that could be wrong with clothing couldn't have been wrong with this. Otherwise, how could God say, take it out of Egypt and put it on your children? There is a Torah Tamimu who says a cute thing. He says that they were to take adult clothing and put it on their children because the adults wore mini clothes. And it would fit the children very nicely, but not the adults. So that's what he says. But in any case, but what's the pshat? Right? It doesn't mean only put it on your children. It means even your children. And you wear it too. So what was the purpose? God said, Einachinami, you won't be able to find anything wrong halachically, intrinsically wrong with this clothing. It's not shatnez, it's not immodest. Had you worn it, however, the last 210 years in Egypt, you never would have gone out of Egypt. How could that be? If it's glatt kosher clothing, why, if they had worn it in Egypt, wouldn't they have gone out? What was wrong? The answer is, had they worn it in Egypt, they would have been wearing it to be like a goy. And that's treif, even though there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the clothing itself. But the situation makes it wrong, because now you're in Egypt, and goyim wear that kind of clothing. To wear that kind of clothing, to blend in, to assimilate with the goyim, even though there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the clothing, is 100% wrong. Now you're going out of Egypt, you're going to be in the desert. There aren't going to be any Egyptians around. Then you can judge the clothing on its intrinsic value. If it's not shatnez and it's not immodest, wear it. There's no goyim around anymore. There's no Egyptians. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have any implications. I'll give you two examples of this idea, where something may not be intrinsically wrong. I'll give you three examples even. And yet, under the circumstances, it becomes wrong. When I was growing up, I was in high school, so the rage of the time was the Beatles. A band from Liverpool, and the Beatles created a fad in the world that men started growing long hair, because the drummer of the Beatles had long hair. Until then, the only ones who had long hair of men were recluses, hippies, but not the normal, you know, respectable businessman. But since this drummer had long hair, he started the fad that men started growing long hair. And whatever affects the Goyish world affects the Jewish world too, even the frum world. So in my yeshiva, in high school, some of my friends stopped taking haircuts and started growing long hair, until it became looking like a co-ed high school. So my rabbonim, one Friday, called these boys in, and he said to them, if you don't take a haircut today, L'Kavod Shabbos, and come back on Sunday with normal-sized hair, you are suspended from school. You can't come back. Right? So they said, well, Rebbe, what's wrong? Right? What's wrong with long hair? A Nazir grows his hair long, and he's called holy. We want to be holy people. They said, you ever see a picture of the Ragachover Gaon? The Ragachover never took a haircut because he didn't want to take his yarmulke off. He had a big head of hair. We want to be like the Ragachover. So my Rebbe was not impressed, and he said, you know, there may be nothing wrong intrinsically with having long hair. Maybe not. The Ragachover had long hair. A Nazir could have long hair. But if the reason you're growing long hair is to be like the Beatles, that's treif like a pig. That's treif v'chazer. It may be nothing intrinsically wrong with it, but it depends what its implications are. And for the implications for you are something that's treif. So in another generation, another person, another time and place, maybe nothing wrong with having long hair. But here, in this generation, it's something 100% wrong. I'll give another example. In the time of the Haskalah, where the Maskilim said that Torah Shebaal Peh was a waste of time to learn, right? They ridiculed the Gemara and learning Gemara, but they didn't want to give up the Torah completely, so they studied Tanakh, and that became the whole focus of learning, and they studied it academically, not as something Kodesh. So in the yeshiva world, the reaction to that, that's not the word I'm looking for, but the reaction to that, right, was that they stopped learning Tanakh and de-emphasized it in order to fight the Haskalah. And that means that Tanakh, what could be wrong with Tanakh? But in the time when Tanakh becomes a symbol of Kfirah, a symbol of rebellion against Torah, then the Tanakh also has to be de-emphasized. That's also possible. The same thing happened with the Aseres HaDibros. They used to say the Aseres HaDibros as part of Tefillah every day, just like Kriyat Shema. It was said as part of davening. Until the early Christians said that there's nothing significant in the Torah except the Ten Commandments. So the rabbis, the backlash, that's what I was looking at. The reaction to that was, we are going to de-emphasize the Ten Commandments. Not going to stop keeping them, but we're going to de-emphasize them because the Christians are using them as a rebellion against the Torah. So, give you another example, where something in one place could be perfectly okay, another place be 100% prohibited. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, so I went to buy sukkah decorations, my first sukkah's here. It's in Tintamei Asharim, in Geula. And I noticed they're selling sukkah decorations that are Christmas decorations in the original packing. Not looked like Christmas decorations. They were Christmas decorations, said on the thing in English. Except they couldn't read English, the people were buying them. And it was like unbelievable. And these Yerushalmis were buying up these things, what's it called, these Christmas decorations. That's what they used for Noi Sukkah. I was sure I was going to go Chol HaMoed into Mei Asharim and see a sukkah with a little baby and a mother and a shepherd, a few shepherds around, right, as sukkah decorations. And they were going to tell me, wow, look at this, Ganze Mishpacha, what's it called, nice sukkah decoration. Now, here in Yerushalayim, there is no implication to that because there's no Christians around. They never saw Christmas decoration, never saw a Christmas tree, right? It's totally out of the realm here. And therefore, these are nice decorations. I'm sure if Yerushalmi would go to America around December, he would say that the Goyim stole our sukkah decorations. But in America, if you'd use those sukkah decorations, you're over an issur of chukas ha-goyim. You're copying the Goyim. But depends who you're copying. In Yerushalayim, there are no Goyim like that to copy. And therefore, adarabba, they stole our sukkah decorations. In America, you're copying the Goyim using those decorations. So what's okay in one place is not okay in another place. And there's a lot of other examples, but for now, that's enough, I think. So therefore, a person has to know every day to reassess the Torah according to the time, place, factors of that place, that time, that period in your life. It could be that when you were young, you approach the Torah one way, right, with tremendous strength, and you what's it called, you didn't eat too much, and you didn't sleep too much, and you were really gung-ho. Now, it's 40 years later, and you're not so young anymore. And if you're going to approach the Torah in that way, right, it's going to kill you. So you have to slow down a little bit. So you have to reassess the Torah according to your stage in life, according to your place, according to the times, according to the implications, and relate to the Torah accordingly. Okay, that's what we learn from B'chol Yom Yubeinecha Kechadoshim. And therefore, you also have to know, it says, Zechor Yemos Olam, Binu Shnos Dor Vador. Remember the days of yore, recognize the years of every generation. But the word Shnos can also mean the differences. Shoneh, how one generation is different than the other. In order to learn from history, you have to learn from history that there are different times and different places, and things change over history, and therefore understand the differences and the changes, and know how to react in your time to the Torah the proper way. And therefore, a person has to know how to package the Torah to every situation properly, and to every group of people properly. If you speak, right, the same words that would give great strength and an inspiration to a yeshiva bacher, the same way to somebody who is totally estranged from Judaism, right, one of them is not going to be impressed. One of them is not going to get the message. You have to tailor make and clothe and package your words the right way. It says that's what Yirmiyahu HaNavi asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to give him Loshon Limudim, a learned way of speaking, La'us L'yo'ef Davar, to give La'us, it tells Rosh Hashiva says, means to fit it to the times, to speak in a way that fits the time and place of who you're talking to. I learned this lesson very strongly when I was a rabbi in Miami. We wanted to make a rally for the chizuk of Torah, of Shabbos, a Shabbos rally, to strengthen people in Shemira Shabbos. So we invited a very famous rav from out of the city, from out of the state, to come and to give chizuk, right? It would be an attraction, right? Well-known person. Person got up, and for about half of his speech, maybe a third of his speech, right, as a guzma, he spoke about the following problem of people not respecting the Shabbos properly. That many of them unscrew some of the bulbs in their chandeliers and don't have the chandelier burning in its full force for Shabbos, but to save money, they unscrew some of the bulbs, and that's a zilzul in Kavod Shabbos. Now let me tell you, in Miami, that was not the major problem of Shmiras Shabbos, unscrewing the bulbs on the chandelier before Shabbos. There were much more serious problems that we wanted him to address. In fact, most of the people in Miami never even knew what a chandelier was or had one. In his community, that may have been an issue, right? But in this community, it wasn't an issue at all. And basically, he wasted a third of his time, right, speaking about something that was totally irrelevant to the people who were listening to him. If you don't know how to package the Torah to fit the people that you're speaking to, right, then you're not going to get the message across. The Torah doesn't change, but the packaging has to change according to the time, place, and the people who you're speaking to. So, therefore, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says, that which it says, that you only have the Shofet, or the Kohen, who's in your time, is not a Nebuch. It's not that, well, wow, we could really wish we could go to the Vilna Gaon, that he would be resurrected, and we could go to him, or we could go to Aaron HaKohen. But Nebuch, we have this Shlemiel Kohen in our time, and we have this guy who, compared to the Vilna Gaon, is nothing, right? But we have no choice. We don't live in the time of the Vilna Gaon or the time of Aaron HaKohen, so we're stuck with this. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, no. If the Vilna Gaon would come back tomorrow, you couldn't go to him as a Shofet in your time. You have to go to the Shofet who knows your generation. The Vilna Gaon didn't live in your generation. He doesn't know your generation, and he is not qualified to paskin things in your generation. When Reb Moshe Feinstein was asked shailos that had to do with Eretz Yisrael, he said, ask the Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael. They know the situation in Eretz Yisrael. I know the halacha, but I don't know the situation in Eretz Yisrael the way they do. They have to be able to apply the halacha to their place, their time, their surroundings, right? The things that apply in Eretz Yisrael. And there are a lot of factors that makes the halacha different in one place than another place. And therefore, he says the same thing in America. So American Gedolim have to pass him for America, not Eretz Yisrael the Gedolim. They don't know what America is all about. They don't know what the implications here are. And the halacha depends on each place according to what is dependent on that place. It changes for people too. If a rich man comes and asks a shaila, he may be told what he has as trait. And if for a poor man, it may be kosher. Because behefsid maruba, where it's a big loss, that same thing that's trait for this one is kosher for this one. So you can't give halacha, psak halacha, in a vacuum. That's why you can't paskin from a computer program. You have to know the person. You have to know the situation. Right? You have to be sensitive to that situation. So, therefore, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says, that's why you are not stuck with the shofet of your generation, but it's only one that you can go to is the one who knows your generation. And the same thing with the Kohen. You want to come and be Makir Tova. God gave us Eretz Yisrael. Here's my Bikurim. The Kohen is the one you have to interact with to bring out your emotions of gratitude. Each generation has a different way of expressing that gratitude because of the specific circumstances of that generation. Each one sees a different facet of Eretz Yisrael that they have to be thankful for based on what happened in that generation. One generation sees one facet of Eretz Yisrael, different generation, because of the circumstances of that generation, sees a different facet of Eretz Yisrael. And if you want to give gratitude properly, you have to be able to, what's it called, to know what your facet of your generation is. You need the Kohen to be able to direct you and to guide you. So it's only the Kohen of your generation who can do that. And that's why it says that Eliyahu Navi is going to be the one to paskin all the shailas that came up throughout the generations that were unresolved. Why not Moshe Rabbeinu? Why not Rabbi Akiva? Eliyahu Navi was the greatest Talmud Chacham of all time. Doesn't seem like that. So why Eliyahu Navi is the one to answer and resolve all these questions? The answer is, I think the Sefer Beis Elokim says, because Eliyahu Navi spanned all generations. He's around in every generation. He knows the generation. He's still alive, and he comes back. Only someone who's aware of all the differences of each generation can be the one to Paskin for every generation. Moshe Rabbeinu hasn't been around. Neither has Rabbi Akiva, right? And therefore, they're not capable of paskening shilas that came up in various generations. Only Eliyahu HaNavi is. So therefore, the Torah says you should go both to the Kohen who lives in your time and to the Shofet who lives in your time, because for halachic guidance, you need to put the halacha in the framework, in the background of the time and place and people you're dealing with. The same thing when you come to emotions and gratitude and how to react emotionally to the Torah, also you have to put it in the backdrop of time, place, circumstance, and people. That's the lesson. It's a very important lesson, right? Because people don't understand that, right? End up learning from things of different times and different places, right? Things that they think are okay to do where they are when they're not, or things that they think are not okay to do where they are and they are. Well, not only okay, but they should be things that are beneficial to do. And only the leaders of the generation have to be the ones to make the calls of what's the time and place and circumstances, and therefore what should be the approach. Not every soldier decides how to fight battles with what weapons. It has to be the leaders, right, the generals. But that's the people you have to go to for direction to know what's proper in your time, in your place, in your circumstances.